This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
Miles de personas. Realidad concreta.
Thousands of people. The concrete truth, raw, fleeing their country, fleeing crime, insecurity, fleeing the lack of jobs,
hombres,
men,
mujeres,
women,
niños,
children.
You're listening to sound from a Facebook Live video of a caravan of migrants marching their way north from Honduras this week. Last Friday, the group included 160 people. Today, there could be as many as 4,000. Many of them are trying to reach the United States, but all of them say they're fleeing an increasingly desperate situation, like this Honduran mother who was interviewed by Plaza Pública, a Guatemalan news organization.
There is nothing more difficult than waking up in the morning with your child saying, "Mom, I'm hungry." And then you begin counting your cents to see how you're going to buy him some juice. Meanwhile, the big business owners throw their food away.
President Trump has urged Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, known as the Northern Triangle, to stop the people from traveling north, threatening to pull funding to those countries. On Twitter today, he also threatened the use of military force. But the migrants continue their journey. Reports emerged Wednesday that a second caravan is also organizing with hundreds of migrants traveling from southern Honduras. I'm joined now by two journalists covering these caravans closely. Nina Lacani and Sarah Kanosian are both freelance reporters covering Mexico and Central America. And they both join me now from Mexico City. Nina and Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Nina, let's start with you. What's the latest on the two migrant caravans that I described earlier? Where are they coming from, and are they mostly men, children, women? Who are in these caravans?
Last night, around 4,000 people slept in and around Guatemala City. So they're the ones you'd call the first caravan, though it's sort of grown gradually over the last 5 days. There's a mix of people. There are entire families, parents, grandparents, children, single parents with their kids, unaccompanied teenagers or teenagers who are traveling with relatives or friends. There's single men. There's at least one person in a wheelchair. There's pregnant women. So it's a real mix of people. And they mostly slept in and around Guatemala City last night and will be making their way towards the Mexican border today. We're not sure if that's going to happen as one big group or they're going to leave in small groups in waves. So that's the first caravan. Then in Honduras, we have hundreds of people gathering in different points of the country, I understand. I know in the north last night in La Ceiba, several hundred people were gathering and planning to leave either late last night or early this morning. What we had happen yesterday was around 500 people from Choluteca, which is in the southern part of Honduras, which has been ravaged by climate change and coastal destruction, arrived at the Guatemalan border, but were refused entry. There was a whole wall of riot police that refused to let them pass, which is absolutely illegal. I mean, there is a migration agreement between four Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, which allows people free movement as long as they have their national ID card. But the Guatemalan authorities were demanding passports. Very few Hondurans have passports, and they were denied entry. So they, I understand, slept sort of near the border last night and will try again today. I imagine when they're joined by the rest of the people who are gathering around the country.
Nina, can you tell us what the conditions are in Honduras that are forcing people to leave the country?
It's a toxic mix of extreme poverty, violence, corruption, and almost total impunity. There was a coup in 2009, since when hundreds of thousands of people from Honduras have been forced to leave or been forcibly displaced because they cannot make enough money to feed their families. You know, the basic salary, the minimum wage, does not buy a basket of food. You know, they call it the canasta básica, which is, you know, your main sort of basic items that anyone would need to keep their families going. It doesn't cover that. And on top of that, you have uniforms for school, you know, basic sort of equipment. The health system has collapsed. It's collapsed because it's been bankrupt in, you know, through corruption. The education system is failing. And then you have, you know, extreme violence. You have gangs in the urban areas, which I talked about a lot, and causing, you know, misery in communities. But you also have state-sponsored violence. You have paramilitary groups. You have other types of organized crime groups. And the state is implicated in a large amount of this violence, and there is almost total impunity. So where do people go? You know, when I was looking at those images yesterday of people not being allowed to cross, you're trapping in people inside a country which is like, you know, creating this huge jail, not allowing them to leave and escape extreme violence and poverty.
Sarah, I want to bring you in here. President Trump threatened to cut aid to Honduras earlier this week. Last year, the U.S. gave about $180 million to that country. What kind of programs does the U.S. fund, and are they effective?
Yeah, so out of the $181 million, about $30 million went to borders and drugs, counter-narcotics operations. $65.5 million around there went to more domestic security, so that's justice sector reform, police reform, violence prevention. Around $55 million goes to education, small business, agriculture, and $31.5 million goes supposedly to improving institutions, transparency, and human rights.
You said supposedly, meaning?
I mean, a lot of the aid is directed at improving institutions, you know, in terms of looking at the counter-narcotics. You know, there's $14 million going through the Department of Defense and $10 million more going to drug interdiction. But I think, I mean, even within that aid, there's certain questions that are raised to the efficacy of it. The current defense minister, the current police chief, and the president's own brother have all been implicated in drug trafficking. So that, you know, that calls into the efficacy of some of the aid that we're spending on counter-narcotics operations. But, you know, a large part of the aid is directed supposedly at addressing some of the root causes that Nina had mentioned. So cutting off aid to some of these efforts, you know, could stifle some of the initiatives that are, you know, directed at trying to address some of those problems.
And Sarah, the United States has a big military presence in Honduras. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, currently, you know, there's a major military base called the Sotocana Air Base that has 500 to 600 troops, and it's the hub of all counter-narcotics operations in Central America. But, you know, Honduras is one of the U.S.'s closest allies in the region, if not the closest militarily. It's always had a pretty close relationship. In the 1980s, it served as a staging ground for the U.S.'s covert war against communism in Latin America. You know, it's where they trained right-wing forces for operations in El Salvador and Nicaragua. You know, and then you bring that up into today, where it's the closest ally in Central America, where it receives the most aid.
I want to play a clip from Mike Pence. Just a day before the caravan set out from Honduras, the vice president spoke at a conference on security, and here's what he had to say.
We also need all the nations in the region to reinforce a very simple message to your people. And it's a message from the heart. And that is, don't put your families at risk by taking the dangerous journey north to attempt to enter the United States illegally. If they can't come to the United States legally, they should not come at all.
Nina, what's your response to Pence's comments?
Desperate people do desperate things. None of these people have undertaken this grueling journey, almost 3,000 miles from home, because, you know, it's something they fancy doing for fun. They're doing it because they see no other choice. And they've all left together because they see safety in numbers. You know, Mexico is one of the most dangerous migration passages in the world. There are multiple risks, and they feel that if they come together, they may stand a better chance of making it alive to the US border. So whatever Mike Pence says, the families who have left together, they're going to just try. You know, I've had so many people say to me over the years, well, you know, I'd rather try dying than stay in Honduras and die of hunger or die because a gang kills me. I'm just going to give it a shot.
And I'm wondering how many of those folks are watching what's happening with the president's, President Trump's family separation policy, the potential for this to happen again. Is that of concern at all, Nina?
I think they will know about it, you know, but I think they will also be thinking, but hang on, my neighbor got over the border last year. I have a cousin that managed to make it. Maybe I'll be lucky. You know, that's how desperate people are. They're going on the whim and the prayer, you know. They think, hang on, I do know people that have got across. I do know people that were, you know, were detained and were deported, but maybe I'll be one of the lucky ones and it's worth giving it a try.
Sarah, I'm wondering about the concerns about the Mexican government and whether they will attempt to repress the current migrants that are coming up. Are you hearing any of that in Mexico City?
Well, yesterday, the Mexican government sent more troops down to the border, and Mexico has deported even more Central Americans than the United States, despite what President Trump may, you know, say on his Twitter feed. The Mexican government has deported thousands more migrants back to Central America. And so it remains to be seen if there's going to be sort of a standoff or, like as Nita had mentioned before, if people are going to be splitting up into smaller groups, which would definitely change the dynamic.
I'm also wondering, you know, we often assume that when folks are migrating from this region, they're migrating to the United States, regardless of the political climate. And I'm wondering, are there other countries or other places that migrants would consider, given the current political climate in the United States?
Since 2014, you know, when the Southern Front plan was launched, that happened after the humanitarian crisis was announced, and it just became much more perilous to make that journey through Mexico. You know, there was a huge increase in Mexican migration agents. People will be detained and deported, not just at the southern border, but all through the country. At that point, Mexico, you know, really started to convert from a transit country into a destination country. And how we measure that is by the number of people who were asking for asylum in Mexico just from 2014 to last year. I think it's quadrupled. And I think that that's another important point. Lots of the people who are in that caravan, I'm sure, would qualify for refugee status under international law. You know, so they're not all economic migrants. You know, huge numbers of these people are actually fleeing death threats, imminent threats to their lives, and they would qualify for refugee status. And we've seen that many people have been asking for refugee status in Mexico. You have seen that happen in Belize, for example. There's been a big increase in Salvadorans, and specifically Salvadorans and Guatemalans, because during the civil wars in the 1980s and 90s, Belize was a destination country for those two nations. In Costa Rica, you have seen some increase, but it's been mainly Nicaraguans fleeing the repression by the Ortega regime. But Mexico, Belize, for sure.
Nina Lacani and Sarah Kenossian are both freelance reporters covering Mexico and Central America. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Houston Astros are vying for a chance to win back-to-back World Series titles.
Bradley Jr., a high fly ball to right. Reddick is at the wall, can only watch. A grand slam! Jackie Bradley Jr., a knockout punch here in the eighth.
Pitcher Roberto Osuna may have lost some Astros fans when he gave up that home run during Tuesday's close game. The Astros are currently down 3-1 against the Boston Red Sox in the American League Championship Series. But Osuna's place on the team has also been questioned for reasons unrelated to his pitching since he joined the Astros last August. In June, Major League Baseball suspended Osuna 75 games for violating the league's domestic violence policy. And while he was still suspended, the Astros picked him up in a trade from the Toronto Blue Jays. Then the Astros made another move. This week, they announced a partnership to address domestic violence in the Houston area. Whitney McIntosh is a reporter covering baseball for SB Nation. Thanks for being with us, Whitney.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
So there's not a lot of information public right now about the Osuna domestic violence charge. What do we know about it?
So what we do know is that he was arrested back in May, early May, in Canada for an assault on an unnamed female victim. And that case then a police report was filed, but because it was in Canada, things are just a little different. Things are a little bit more under lock and key, whereas in the U.S. we would probably know some details. What we know, trial dates were pushed back throughout the summer while he was suspended, and eventually, just about over a month ago, the criminal case was wrapped up with a peace bond, which is about approximately the equivalent of a probationary, restraining order situation in the U.S. He has a year of probation. He's not allowed to speak to the victim. And essentially that was because the victim, who lives in Mexico, did not want to travel back to Canada to testify. So they had no reasonable expectation of conviction. So that's where we stand. The suspension has ended. And the details are just a little fuzzier because we don't have that police report to refer to or an actual criminal trial that, you know, went underway.
So let's talk a little bit about MLB's current domestic violence policy. Like, what is it? It's only been around for a couple of years, but it's led to some long-term suspensions, like in the case of Osuna.
Yes. So MLB's current domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse policy was implemented in 2015. There have been a handful of investigations and suspensions to this point, and Osuna was the third highest suspension. So it was a pretty significant suspension. It was the third or fourth one this year, actually. Most recently, Addison Russell of the Cubs was suspended 40 games for domestic abuse. So there have been players suspended before and after Osuna. He is not the first. But again, his situation is very specific because there was a trade that was involved. But MLB doesn't necessarily, similar to other sports in this, they do not necessarily wait until a criminal case has been completed. They do their own investigation. They speak to victims on their own time. They may not speak to a victim at all when they take their final decision into account. And overall, the process is a little bit kind of like Osuna's case. It's a little bit non-transparent. We don't have a ton of information about why Osuna was 75 games, Addison Russell was 40, a handful of players have been in the 15 to 30 range in the past few years. We don't really know what MLB's investigation consists of. So it's a little tough, and it does make it, it does open them up to speculation quite a bit, especially in the Osuna case. You're saying he's the third highest, you know, number of games. He must have done something awful. But we don't know, and we have no way of telling. So it's a little tricky. And players suspended under the policy are, as we've seen, eligible to play in the postseason compared to players suspended for steroids or performance-enhancing drugs, which are not eligible to play in the postseason. So that's a little bit of a tricky line as well. So there's definitely some criticisms there, some issues of transparency as far as how their investigations go about. But it's been a few years, and, you know, I think on a case-by-case basis, it's worked on varying levels for them as they'd like it to.
The Astros decided to trade to get Osuna while he was still suspended. And I guess and when he was speaking to the New York Times earlier this week, the general manager said this, quote, "Did we take a risk? No question. Are there people that are still upset about it? No question. We'll do whatever we can at this point, supporting the relevant causes." And he went on to say that Osuna actually makes the team stronger. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's the way I've seen it, the Astros have been a little bit callous in this case. You know, this is not the first time that a team has traded for an alleged or confirmed domestic abuser in order to win a World Series. The Cubs did this with Aroldis Chapman, a star closer currently on the Yankees, a few years ago, and it did win them a World Series, and it worked, and fans kind of had to come to terms with whether that was worth it. With Osuna, the Astros have been a little bit more blatant about that's what we're doing. You know, he throws good pitches. He's going to win. He could win us a World Series.
Winnie, what's interesting about this story is that the Astros now have a domestic violence campaign. Tell us about that. Is that purely for the optics of having gotten Osuna? Is that a real serious campaign that they really have put a lot of energy behind? What is this campaign?
I think it can be both, but it does come across as significant PR spin. Jim Crane, owner of the Astros, did openly admit kind of, now that we've traded for Osuna, we want to make sure that domestic violence awareness is an important thing for the Astros Foundation, which has a $30 million endowment. So again, he kind of said the quiet part out loud. We traded for a domestic abuser. Now we'd like to do the work in the community that hopefully makes us feel better about that.
It feels like they're trying to have it both ways.
It does. The players have been saying, oh, he's a great clubhouse presence. You know, Jeff Luhnow and AJ Hinch, GM and manager of the team, have kind of been like, he's a great player. He can put that pass behind him. It's great. And now they're donating around $300,000 to local women's shelters in the Houston, Texas area in partnership with the Texas Council on Family Violence. So they have put the work in. They have cooperated, but it is a little bit having it both ways.
We will see. Whitney McIntosh is a reporter covering baseball for SB Nation. Whitney, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
This week, Canada became the first G7 nation to legalize recreational marijuana. And they're only the second country in the world to do so, following Uruguay. On Wednesday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who ran on a platform of legalization, was asked if he uses marijuana now that it's legal.
I've said many times that I'm not a drug user. I don't drink much alcohol. I don't drink coffee. I have no intention of using marijuana.
Trudeau says his intent with legalization is to keep profits out of the hands of organized crime and to keep cannabis away from kids. So, will those things happen? And what impact will this have on the U.S.? Vanmala Subramaniam is a cannabis reporter for the Financial Post, and she joins me now from Toronto. Vanmala, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, that's a fantastic beat.
It's very interesting, actually.
Fantastic. Well, you're the expert here. Tell us what this means for recreational marijuana is now legal in Canada. What does that mean? Can I just go to a store and get some?
Yes. Okay. So essentially what it means is that you're allowed to possess up to 30 grams of cannabis. Anyone living in Canada is allowed to possess up to 30 grams of cannabis. It also means that you can just purchase cannabis freely in any kind of online retail store, or some brick and mortar stores that, you know, are licensed by the government. They only exist in some provinces so far. In Ontario, for instance, the only way you can actually purchase legal cannabis is through one store that is controlled by the government online. It's called the Ontario Cannabis Store. But over time, you're going to see a lot more retail shops pop up, which essentially means that, you know, if you're walking down the street in downtown Toronto, eventually, probably next spring, you'll be able to just walk into a store and buy some dried flower.
Now, we know, obviously, Canada is our northern neighbor. Will this have any impact on the border between Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a lot of discussion about if you're working in the cannabis industry in Canada, are you going to be asked questions and stopped at the border when you get across? So the way in which the messaging has gone out from the U.S. side is quite interesting. So in the beginning, they said, you know, if you work in the industry, or if you have any kind of affiliation in this legal industry, even though you're crossing into a U.S. state where medical marijuana or rec is legal, you will not be able to get across the border, even if you're not carrying cannabis on you. So now, 2 weeks ago, the U.S. kind of backtracked on that. And they said, actually, if you work in the marijuana industry in Canada, you will be able to get across the border as long as you're not going to the U.S. for work, which is very interesting and also very problematic, because there's a very strong business relationship that the U.S. has with Canada when it comes to weed. A lot of American companies, because, you know, weed is not federally legal there, are listed on Canadian stock exchanges, which means that there's just a very strong business relationship. There's a lot of capital, a lot of U.S. money flowing to the Canadian cannabis sector. And so there's bound to be travel between Canadians and Americans across the border for reasons of, you know, cannabis business. Recreational weed is legal in 9 states in the U.S. and D.C. So in many of these states like California, Colorado, Oregon, Washington State, there are numerous businesses, retail businesses, you know, venture capitalists focused on investing in the marijuana industry. But the problem is, how do these businesses raise money, right? The only way they can raise money, because it's still quite a stigmatized drug, is if they can list on another stock exchange and they can go public. Essentially, you know, they can get an average investor to invest in them. So what a lot of these businesses have done, and it's quite significant, my last count was about, you know, 20 over American cannabis businesses are listed on the Canadian Securities Exchange, the CSE, which is now being dubbed the POT Index because of, you know, the number of cannabis companies listed on it. And so as a Canadian or an American, you can buy, you can invest in these companies in Canada, but you can't do that in the US. So that is the first, I guess, like, you know, most tangible, strongest relationship between the US and Canada on cannabis.
Let's talk a little bit about the legalities of this and the criminality of marijuana and cannabis. I mean, we have this issue in the United States where there are some states that have it legal, as you mentioned, some do not. But we spoke to Akwasi Owosu-Bempah, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto and the director of research for the Campaign for Cannabis Amnesty. And he gave us some information about Canada's history of criminalization of this drug and also discrimination. Let's take a listen.
Canada was at the forefront of criminalizing many drugs with the Opium Act of 1908, and then following the U.S. with the criminalization of cannabis in 1923. And not only were we early to do so, but our drug laws were also quite racially motivated. And so our initial drug laws targeted our Asian as well as our Black populations. And we've seen that play out since then in the way in which those laws were enforced.
Vanmala, I'm curious, are there similar disparities today prior to this legalization in Canada?
Yeah, there are. Actually, Vice did a really good investigation last year about this, where they found out cannabis charges for pot possession were disproportionately amongst Black Canadians and Indigenous people in certain cities. And, you know, the fact of the matter is there's a big hypocrisy in the way in which the government has gone about legalization. And the reason why I say this is because there are examples of politicians, former DEA officials, actually former police officials, investing in the legal cannabis space. And there has been very little movement on the front to pardon people for very simple pot possession charges. Like, for instance, more than 500,000 Canadians have a criminal record for having pot on them. So having weed, so for possessing a small amount of weed.
Now, Vanmala, I do want to ask you a question, though. There is some legislation that's attempting to change some of these convictions.
Yes, there is a movement building to expunge this. Justin Trudeau has said that it is his plan. However, a timeline hasn't been laid out. So I would just end by saying it is there, the conversation's there, a movement is building to expunge people, but it hasn't actually come into reality. It's a good thing that the movement's there, though.
Vanmala Subramaniam is a cannabis reporter for the Financial Post, and I spoke to her from Toronto. Thanks, Vanmala.
Thank you.
The investigation continues into journalist Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance from a Saudi consulate in Turkey. The crisis has brought international attention to the economic and political power dynamics at play in the region. And while the U.S. has relied on Saudi Arabia as a critical partner in the Middle East, the Saudi kingdom is also behind much of the instability in countries like Yemen and Syria. Here to talk about the potential geopolitical fallout from all this is Nader Hashmi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. Professor Hashmi, welcome to The Takeaway.
I'm happy to be with you.
If you could, Professor, help us understand where we are politically in the region right now. What are the strongest alliances and which are the ones that are most strained?
Well, the main alliance in the Middle East today is the Saudi-Emirati alliance that I think is allied very intimately with Israel, with strong support from the Trump administration. I think these players are hoping to rewrite the geopolitics and the political map of the Middle East by pursuing a series of very aggressive policies toward their adversaries, fundamentally rooted in strengthening authoritarian allies in the region, crushing civil societies, and playing very hardball with other countries in the region.
Do you expect that all of these things could potentially lead to another uprising, similar to what we saw in the Arab Spring?
I think inevitably it will, to think that, you know, millions of people, many of them young, with aspirations for a better future, are simply going to accept to live under different forms of despotism forever, I think is wishful thinking. And I think in many ways that really is the Faustian bargain that many people in the West have calculated on, that these authoritarian regimes can simply keep things under control, assuming that people will be too tired or too disillusioned to resist and revolt. And of course, with revolutions and revolts, we never can predict when they'll happen, but I'm almost certain another revolt of some form is inevitable.
Well, and I will also, you know, the Arab Spring was in 2010, 2011. We're now in a very different moment. At least internationally, the United States has a different president and a different administration. I'm wondering, what about that longstanding relationship and support that the United States and Saudi Arabia have had? This isn't a Trump phenomenon solely. This is something that the United States and Saudi Arabia have had for quite some time. Do you think that that relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States could be affected by what we're seeing right now on the ground?
Well, I think it's bound to be affected. I mean, you're absolutely right to suggest that this is simply not to be diminished to Donald Trump. The U.S.-Saudi relationship, and more broadly, the U.S. relationship to the region goes back to World War II, where the United States effectively struck up a series of alliances with autocrats and authoritarian regimes, hoping that they would preserve stability, advance American interests.
In this particular incident that we're talking about with Jamal Khashoggi, the United States, and specifically President Trump, has sort of played two sides of this coin. On the one hand, they're defending the Saudis. They're saying they're a regional partner. On the other hand, they're being confronted with more and more and more evidence. Just yesterday, we heard there was an audio recording of what could potentially be Khashoggi's last moments. Then that evidence is showing that this could, in fact, be a state-sanctioned Saudi murder. What type of danger could there be in continuing that alliance given this increasing evidence?
Well, the danger is that it's simply going to perpetuate a very odious regime in Riyadh that is responsible for a lot of the regional instability. So I think the danger here is that it's simply going to deepen the instability in the region. It's going to generate more anti-American hostility. It's going to embolden autocrats and dictators around the world who see that at least this administration in Washington, D.C. is willing to go to bat, apologize, deflect criticism from the policies of authoritarian regimes. So it's going to have a lot of destabilizing consequences. We've invested heavily in these regimes. We've invested heavily in this particular crown prince, hoping that he would be our savior. And all of the warnings that people were issuing with respect to this policy, with respect to this particular crown prince, no one took seriously. And this is not just a Republican Trump problem. This goes across the political spectrum, and as I stated a moment ago, it has deep historical roots. This is the consequences of investing in authoritarianism and political tyranny and ignoring human rights and basic questions of democracy and good governance.
And we also know that the Washington Post published a final opinion piece from Jamal Khashoggi last night, which they had received right before his death or disappearance. And in it, he writes about the need for free expression in the Arab world. Can you tell us what the role of the press and the media is in Saudi Arabia and how that impacts what people there understand about what's happening in the rest of the region?
The role of the press and the media in Saudi Arabia is to effectively repeat the propaganda of the Saudi royal family. I mean, there is no independent press. There is no free media. That's one of the reasons why Jamal Khashoggi had to leave and move to the United States. And so the role of the media in Saudi Arabia is not that different from the role of the media in any authoritarian regime. In Saudi Arabia, I think it's much worse because the nature and the level of the repression, particularly under this crown prince, has moved in a much more ugly and repressive direction. You know, this final op-ed that that Jamal has written is worth pondering. It's worth thinking about. But it's it's important that we think about this concept and this idea of a free press in relationship to U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia. We haven't been pursuing a free press in Saudi Arabia. We haven't been pursuing human rights. We've been coddling dictators and despots from the time that the United States emerged on the scene in 1945. It's been a consistent policy of downplaying these basic values that we often espouse as being foundational to our own country and our own national identity, but we rarely apply them to our foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East. And I think we have to figure out a way out of this this broken pattern of policies that are, I think, not in the long-term interests of the United States, and they're certainly not in the long-term interests of the people of the Middle East.
Nader Hashmi is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. Professor Hashmi, thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And we've got some good news to end the show on. In the United States today, there is actually more than one open job for every person looking for work. Think about that for a second. Right now, there are more jobs than people able to fill them. At the height of the Great Recession, there were about 6 people looking for work for every vacancy. New Labor Department numbers this week point to a record number of job openings, 7.1 million jobs. And a booming labor market like this means it's also a great time for employees to ask for more money or find a better job. Harry Holzer is with me to talk about why the economy looks the way it does, how workers can benefit, and who is left out of this prosperous moment. Harry is the professor of public policy at Georgetown and a former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzine. It's nice to be here.
So wait, there are jobs? How did we get here?
Well, it's been a long road back. You know, the recovery from the recession technically started in 2009. Only until 2010 did we really start to recover. So we've now been in a recovery for eight and a half years, and that's been the road back to this strong labor market.
So the president, President Trump, tweeted a celebration the other day. He said about these 7.1 million job openings, and the president tweeted, "Astonishing! It's all working." Harry, what does he mean? What is working? Are there Trump administration policies that are contributing to this?
Well, a little bit. I mean, no surprise that the president takes credit for every positive development. Look, this has been a long recovery. What we see is mostly a continuation of a kind of gradual tightening that we saw for 6 years under President Obama. I do think there's a bit of a Trump effect. I think the tax cuts that just started to kick in this year probably have a small effect that bump up the economy and bump up the labor market a little more than it otherwise would have. That doesn't mean it's a good policy because it's like a sugar high. It'll last very briefly. It's really bad policy because eventually we're going to have to pay for those tax cuts one way or the other. The positive effect will wear off within a year or two, we'll be left with trillions of dollars of more debt.
I think there's an important question to ask here, too. There are 7.1 million job openings, but what kind of jobs are we talking about here?
Well, they really cover the full range. And if you look at the vacancy numbers in that report, you see them in a pretty wide range of industries. So, for instance, you see them in professional services, for which you usually need at least a BA, if not some kind of graduate degree. You see some of them in places like construction, where you need some skills, although not necessarily a post-secondary credential. And then you see them in places like leisure and hospitality or even retail trade, where folks without much college or without even work training can get hired as long as they are job ready, as long as they can come in, get to work on time every day, sometimes pass a drug test, et cetera.
We're talking about the labor economy with Harry Holzer, professor of public policy at Georgetown and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry, is it easy or should people start asking for more money? Should people start asking for a raise if they already have a job, given the job market and what it looks like right now?
Well, the average answer to that question is yes. Now, again, it always varies from one industry to the next, one occupation to the next, depending on how many other people in that region are ready to replace you. But yes, these are the best circumstances in over a decade When the labor market is this tight, workers have more bargaining power. And when it's harder to replace them, if they leave, yeah, they have more room to bargain and to ask for pay raises. So overall, it's not a bad strategy right now.
What about wages themselves? We often hear that wages have not kept up with productivity, with unemployment or with employment, that workers are making less today relatively than they were 30, 40 years ago. So where are wages today? Have they gone up as well?
Well, you know, wages have been the most disappointing aspect of this recovery, and we haven't seen great wage growth. The last few months, it looks a little better. The last 2 months, the employment reports have shown wage growth in the 3 to 4% range rather than 2 to 3%. If that lasts, then it looks like we're moving into a new phase where everything looks positive, and we'll see if it lasts. You know, the other thing, of course, is productivity has actually been pretty weak in the last decade or so. So it's hard to have great wage growth without very good productivity growth. But the news from the last few months has been more encouraging.
Can you drill down a little bit more into that? Because I feel like workers are working a lot, and we never stop working. So how? Tell us a little bit about that productivity number.
Well, productivity is really the output of goods and services per hour worked. So it might well be that workers are working a lot of hours and that we have a lot of employment going on. It depends how productive each worker is on average in producing whatever goods and services they produce. And those numbers have been pretty flat. We had a good decade in the late 90s and early 2000s around the dot-com boom. But except for that, they've been pretty flat. And we need to figure out how to get productivity up to have long-term wage and earnings gains and not just a bump while the labor market's tight.
Let's also talk about two groups of people who often don't get highlighted here. There are the long-term unemployed, those folks who just can't seem to get a foothold in the labor market, and also those that say they are underemployed. They're not working the hours or the types of jobs that they want to be working or feel they're qualified to work in. What do you see for those two groups, long-term unemployed and those that are underemployed?
Well, for both those groups, you know, we wish the numbers were a little better. In a labor market this tight, those people have the best prospects they're going to have. But you're right. They have often been left out. A lot of the people who are long-term unemployed have actually left the labor force. They have stopped actively looking for work. For some of them, it's very hard to come back in. They might have gone on disability insurance, or they might have developed an opioid problem, or they might have a criminal record. Lots of stuff can keep them from coming back in. And even when they do start looking for work, you know, that long spell without work can be a negative signal to employers. Like, you know, this guy isn't that trustworthy, depending on who else is applying for that job. They might still get it. So we've seen a small number of the people who had left the labor force trickle back in. And by the way, I'm not talking about retiring baby boomers. I'm talking about people, prime age workers between, say, 25 and 55. There's been a small trickle of those folks back in. A lot have remained out. And of course, the longer they're out, the harder it ever is to come back in. Now, the other group, involuntarily working part-time or not quite in the job they want, this is a good time for them to try to move up the ladder, especially if they have skills or work experience.
Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we want to talk to you, our listeners, about how today's labor market is playing out for you. When did you last get a raise? What did it mean for you? From blue-collar hourly jobs to white-collar roles with big salaries, we want your stories of getting raises and bonuses or just trying to get those things and being turned down.
I'm from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I've worked for the state in workforce development for 15 years. I've never received a bonus. The last raise I received was 2015. It's sad the workforce is crumbling and we still don't value our loyal workers.
Tweet us your stories with the hashtag #MyLastRaise. On Twitter, we're at The Takeaway and I'm at Tanzina Vega. Or you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to our Facebook page. That's all for today. Thanks so much for being with us as always. Until next time, I'm Tanzina Vega and this is The Takeaway.